We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Christopher Bedford is joining me today. He's the editor over at the Common Sense Society and was making it really hard for me to start the podcast because he kept talking about different ridiculous subjects, which are not at all germane to the podcast today. So he thinks it's very funny to continue interrupting.
Yeah, I'm a child.
Yeah. That much is abundantly clear. So, Chris, you wrote a...
Are you pro or anti chasing pigeons?
Chasing pigeons?
Yeah, like
I don't want to get anywhere near
pigeons,
a pigeon.
Just like chase them?
I'm actually... one of my sort of big aversions is birds. I really don't like birds.
Then you wouldn't like my cat. Who is
I do like
taken
your cat.
Into a habit of bringing back a live or dead bird yeah. every day recently. Cats, pretty evil.
Yeah.
Pretty evil.
So, Chris, you wrote a poignant piece yesterday, and we're taping this Thursday, so yesterday was Wednesday. And in D.C., the president of the United States spoke at Union Station in a primetime address, a sort of last-ditch midterm messaging effort. And the result was another speech where he was waxing poetic about American democracy, doing so, though, in Union Station, which... Chris, you wrote a really poignant essay yesterday, and you went to Union Station, the site of President Biden's speech. He was making a sort of primetime, last-ditch, midterm strategy, messaging, address, and he did it from Union Station, which, again, we talk about, and we have for a couple of years, especially with Chris, because it's sort of one of his hobby horses, is talking about beauty and cities, and particularly D.C., where he lived for a long time, where I've lived for a long time and still do. Union Station is not just... a DC issue. Union Station is the gateway to the nation's capital. So as a symbol, it's very important. And literally, it's very important too, because people every day, their first experience in Washington, DC is in Union Station, not to mention it's a transportation hub for the capital and for many, many people. So Joe Biden goes there, clears out the homelessness. He clears out everything just for the speech. Of course, I'm sure it's back to the
probably
state of nature.
Pigeons.
Yeah, probably the pigeons. But Chris, you went down there, you saw what was still, you could still see on the sort of outskirts of the station what had been pushed out and what has been, you know, on those streets for a while. Tell us about your essay. Tell us about what you think the sights that you see at Union Station and that you saw yesterday at Union Station tell us about Biden's speech.
I mean, Union Station was built as a monument as much as a train station.
Right.
At the beginning of the 20th century, I think it opened in 1907 or around that time. It was built to be the grand entrance to the federal city. So you come in from train from the north, or I think the south as well, actually. And you come out in this massive vaulted ceiling that looks like Grand Central, but I think larger. Beautiful columns out front. A statue of Christopher Columbus standing triumphant over his ships. Facing toward the United States Capitol, which is one of the most beautiful buildings in the world. That's how it was designed. This was that was built by America that believed in itself and believed in its future and believed in its past and was proud of its past. We don't have that anymore. Instead, if you go to Union Station right now, what you see is the ghosts of a mall that used to exist. It, for the first 18 years I lived in D.C., first 15 years I lived in D.C., it was a mall. It had you could go there for clothes, you could go there for dinner, you could go there for music or books or magazines, whatever you wanted. Now it's almost entirely empty. One of the two Starbucks locations closed due to violence against their staff.
I think they actually both ended up closing.
They might have both ended up closing.
Yeah.
And it's filled with the mentally ill, the criminally insane. The drug addicts. I mean, when I used to leave our old office and walk up toward Union Station, I remember at one point seeing just an old man collapsed on a 100-degree day against a lamppost while a drug dealer handed him a paper bag for the few greasy dollars he had been able to spend. And this was in broad daylight in front of Capitol Police, in front of United States Police, D.C. Police.
The wreckage of contemporary progressivism is on full display every single day in Union Station, and the severity of that ebbs and flows, but it's been fairly high ever since the pandemic.
I know
in the years
women who have moved out of the city because of it. I was talking to one woman yesterday.
You can't commute
if
you go through there.
Yeah. After I wrote about it, a woman I know reached out and said, I moved to Capitol Hill because I wanted to be near my church and my friends and my community. And I moved back to Texas because the metro station was, I was screamed at every day and menaced.
I was told the other day, a student that I work with needed to go into Union Station on their commute and actually got off at another stop that creates like an extra mile walk, if not more than that, on a commute, mind you, just because it was so important to that person to avoid Union Station.
No, but yesterday it wasn't that way. Yesterday was the nicest I've ever seen it. Yesterday there was no one in the station except for me who was taking pictures. Who like had no business in that station. Everyone there was a commuter. Security was everywhere. People were looking out. The folks who are usually passed out in front of the building or passed out in the windows in the front were passed out a block away instead. And I mean, this is our hangout spot. I walked up and there was one guy. A young guy, whatever drug he was using, he was just swaying back and forth, sitting down unconscious while standing up. And I took a video of him. And I turn around and this other young guy's in a yellow vest, where I assumed was a worker, was just staring at me. And I felt, you know, it's kind of awkward. Okay, I'm filming someone suffering. He's just looking at me funny, like, why are you filming that dude? But didn't say anything. I came back 20 minutes later and that person in the yellow vest was passed out next door. I'm like, oh, you guys both did the same drug. And it's open air drug use.
So this was in Union Station?
This was yesterday. It was right in front of the Post Office Museum. So across the street from Union Station.
Across the street, right. Which is every single day an open air drug scene.
Yes. And what's insane about all of this kind of betrayal of the citizens of the city and the commuters. The businesses, which are all gone, the staff who have to deal with this betrayal of the community is the central aspect of why Democrats are getting their butts kicked up and down and are about to get somewhere between a shellacking and a slaughterhouse on Tuesday for their candidates. It's because of this. Now, Biden never sees anything. Biden's like the king who goes by the Potemkin villages, I'm guessing. He doesn't know what it's actually like to walk in a street and be menaced by a homeless person.
I mean, he went through Union Station every single day as a senator when he was doing his Amtrak commute, and it was a different time. I mean, it was a glistening monument to American greatness. It was gorgeous, and it was real, true beauty, and that's what he would remember it as.
And it's a gorgeous building. It's one of the prettiest around. But he goes there and he doesn't give a speech about the things that are pissing off Americans. He doesn't give the speech about the things that are hurting us. He doesn't give a speech about the things that his and his allies' policies have explicitly caused. That tent city that was just cleaned up over the summer, that was caused. The homeless people don't have $600 tents. Those are bought for them by a combination of activists and government tax dollars. The ability to not move people, the willingness to allow open air drug use and loitering. Those are decisions that are made by the city council, Democrats, by his administration's depolicing aspects. But he doesn't address any of that. Instead, he went there to call Republicans, what was the word he kept on using? Basically,
extreme MAGA Republicans.
Yeah. Autocrats.
Mm-hmm. He talked about autocracy. Yep. He invoked January 6th. He invoked the invasion of the Pelosi home in San Francisco. He hit all of the notes.
Yeah, I watched the first 25 minutes of it before I went to bed, and I was extremely unimpressed with it. But it was threatening, it was menacing, it was calling people. And, you know, and this is the thing that's turning off so many independents.
Yes.
Like, let's look at the independents as like a block, I guess, of suburban women who, I don't know exactly what they're, but who get angry at Donald Trump's mean and social media and a bully on Twitter. And here's Joe Biden going out, and he's doing it nicely. He's doing it from a podium, but he's calling his political opponents Nazis, autocrats, fascists, traitors, and they're being turned off by it. The New York Times poll that we talked about a week or two ago that came out said, hey, independence, or for the people who think that our country is at risk or democracy is at risk, people are harder on the Democrats than they are on the Republicans. They're as hard on Joe Biden about as they are on Donald Trump, and they're most hard on the media. And it was wild to see the Washington Post, we were laughing about it, come out and say, well, the reason here is because the Democrats haven't made the message clear enough that Republicans are fascists who must be destroyed. I think he bought that. And he went out and he did it again. And he chose a place as actual a symbol of the rot of his policies to further expound on the rot of other aspects of their policies.
Well, his policies, but you know, it's not even his policies because he's tried to like play the middle. Remember at last year's State of the Union address, or it was earlier this year, where he said, we're going to fund the police. Well, that's not what Democratic mayors around the country have been winking and nodding at over the last several years. And even before the pandemic, this was happening. So he can't really have it both ways because Democrats aren't having it both ways. They're doing one thing in these cities. And sure, most voters do not live, you know, on Capitol Hill. They don't live in, you know, some of the parts of New York that are experiencing similar things, or Los Angeles or San Francisco, et cetera, et cetera. But they live in the suburbs outside of those cities, and they treasure those cities for their memories, for what they symbolize about their states, about their regions, and, you know, about our economy, at least they used to. But I also think there's something else going on here. Why Democrats keep hammering this and hammering this and hammering this, because we know that midterm elections are about turnout. And for them, this is the thing that separates the voter who sits at home on Tuesday from the voter who gets out of, you know, gets off the couch and actually goes and casts a ballot on Tuesday. Is if we can play on people's emotions using this wildly reckless, dishonest language, then we can win the midterms. And it's all for the common good, right?
I just don't think people buy conspiracies. Even if they're true.
I mean, people bought the Russian collusion conspiracy.
I don't think they really voted as much on that. Maybe. Although it's kind of wild. Like, no one cares about the Republican, even though it's true, George Soros narrative. That there is a foreign billionaire who spends hundreds of millions of dollars to elect radical left-wing DAs, et cetera. Like, they're like, okay, whatever. I don't care about what's going on in my district. Now, they'll put those DAs out of business and out of power when their crime in their city skyrockets. And they're like, oh my gosh, this Soros-backed DA isn't prosecuting. Harry Reid tried to hang the Koch brothers on Republicans' necks. He would go down and give floor speeches all the time. The Kochs. People didn't care about the Koch brothers. Voters didn't care. And now I think Biden's going out there and saying January 6th and this. And people are just looking around them and they're caring about the issues that are most obviously affecting them. What's craziness that's going on in the schools, crime on the streets, inflation.
Well, yeah. And I think this is so I actually just wrote a monologue on this. And that's why it's sort of fresh in my mind. But CBS News had a poll that was released this week that actually asked voters, what's a bigger priority for you, a functioning democracy or a strong economy? And that is such a telling false binary, right? That for most voters,
who asked that poll?
CBS News. And for what most, it's such a tell, right? What they see as a functioning democracy has nothing to do with your ability to feed your kids and put food on the table and have a healthy middle-class family. Democracy.
Middle class is essential to a healthy republic.
Of course. But a functioning democracy, it means that the economy is working across the board, right? That there's upward mobility, that there's a healthy middle class, and you know, just the culture is healthy, basically. But for them, of course, these are two very different things. It's like when people separate the culture war from the economy, as though there's not significant overlap, and in fact, complete overlap between all of them. No, a functioning democracy, why people feel like their democracy isn't functioning is because repeat offenders are getting out of prison and hurting other people. That is not a consensus position. It's not what anybody wants. It's not healthy. And it's the outcome of single party rule in these cities and in these states like Oregon, where somebody like Christine Drazen is like really up in the polls. New York, where Lee Zeldin is really up in the polls. And those they could easily lose either of those elections. The margins are thin. I think both of them are technically down in the average by just like 1 or 2 points, something like
not
that.
Oregon.
Is she up?
Yeah. Well, I mean, but she's very reliant.
It was a huge swing, though.
She's very reliant on the Democratic or the independent doing as well as she's been polling. Mm-hmm. There's basically two Democrats and one Republican running. One of the Democrats said, I'm leaving the Democratic Party and I'm running as an independent. She's backed by Phil Knight. She's backed by a lot of very wealthy people who have been funny. And Phil Knight was asked why you're supporting against a Democratic Party. Why are you going against the Democratic Party? He said, if you see a picture of somebody doing cocaine in Oregon, the illegal part about the picture is the straw. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm running this
and
campaign.
That is not a functioning democracy. And the media is doing the Democrats' bidding.
It's not a functioning society. It might be a functioning democracy as far as mob rule goes.
Right, right, right. Well, I mean, functioning. It depends on how you're interpreting the word functioning. Chris is just anti-democratic.
Thing as a functioning democracy. This democracy is functioning exactly as it would be imagined to. If you tell the founders, hey, we're going to get rid of the middle class and we're just going to have like a democracy. If you're like, well, you're going to get Union Station right quick when people learn how to vote themselves crack.
So Jared,
even the founders had crack.
Jared and Inez Stepman are good. And like they always are reminding us that actually the founders did talk about a constitutional republic with the language of democracy. But it's not what the left means when they mean democracy, because they mean California. Democracy. And there's no such thing as a functioning California democracy.
The founding documents of the American government, according to the left wing, are like the Emma Lazarus poem from the Statue of Liberty and democracy.
Yeah. But the point remains, right, that like a functioning, healthy American system, American experiment, as Joe Biden called it last night on his primetime address on Wednesday, people, when they see what Phil Knight just said, which is if you see a straw, that's the illegal part. That's not functioning. It feels like something is broken to people across the board. And when Democrats are obsessed with this turnout message, I think it's turnout focused. I think some of them definitely think it's their ticket to the hearts of suburban mothers who really don't like Donald Trump. But by the way, they're overwhelmed by negative stuff from Democrats too. I mean, the crime, economy, you can go on down the line, education, books, mandates, like just all of the COVID completely mishandled and Democrats not doing anything to hold themselves accountable, say like, hey, maybe we went over the line in X, Y, and Z cases. Now, politicians rarely ever do that, but there's no spokesperson for the Democratic Party right now. No major spokesperson for the Democratic Party right now that has grappled with any of that, period.
So
let
you
alone,
think that's coming? I mean, lot of these politicians, it's like, the same in the GOP, are cowardly careerists.
Well, you get glimpses of it, like when Joe Biden says, we want to fund the police. I think that starts happening on other issues too.
And you've seen the squad get completely shut down. Mm-hmm. Nancy Pelosi runs
neutered.
Them.
Yep.
If you want forever war in Europe, I mean, the squad will back you up there. They're so far removed from the Bernie Sanders, Tulsi Gabbard kind of original left wing of the modern Democratic Party. But I lost my train of thought.
They're so far removed from the Democratic Party.
I know what I said
a second ago. I was just seeing if maybe it would redirect
the
thought. And indeed it did.
So I'm wondering, are the knives going to come out after what I think, I could be wrong, could go either way, but I think it's going to be a bloodbath on Tuesday.
I tend to agree with you.
Be like that elevator opening in The Shining, just red.
Pollsters, when they're talking to legacy media outlets, say that they are having a really hard time contacting Republicans and getting an accurate sample size of Republicans, which would indicate that they're underpolling Republicans. And in a cycle where Republicans are the opposition party to the president and the economy is bad, I would expect, and crime is fairly high depending on where you're looking at, what crimes you're looking at, I would expect that means that these polls, which actually
the polls are just dumb.
They're dumb and they're bad. And the pollsters are having a hard time, as we talked about with Molly last week, like fixing this science, which it is a science, but...
A poll was released yesterday and I can't remember the name. I think I know what it is, but I'm not going to besmirch them because I'm not sure. That was literally of registered voters in Pennsylvania.
Just name any pollster.
Said, don't worry, these people still support Fetterman. Yeah. Now, it's like it's supposed to soothe you and like make you feel nice, like a warm bath. But the whole problem Fetterman has isn't that there's not enough Democrats in Pennsylvania. It's that they're not going to show up and vote for him because he makes them uncomfortable because he had a stroke and is suffering very obvious physical effects from it. Mm-hmm. So like a poll of registered voters is malpractice 3 months ago. But now it's intentional.
Well, and I actually think really what would show that we're a functioning democracy contra Joe Biden is if you see like Karen Bass in LA, if you see Kathy Hochul in New York, if you see Drazen winning in Oregon, that's going to be a sign that the democracy still has some kick left in it. Because it means that like people who are clearly, if you look at polling, if you talk to people, they're clearly upset by these policies, even in one party states like California and Oregon.
But here's the problem though. Is let's say there's like a very good day for Republicans on Tuesday. What does that mean for the country?
Yeah, what are Republicans? Yeah.
Cool.
Well, but awesome. To your point, it can be a corrective to Democrats, right? So is it the thing that makes the media and Democrats reevaluate their sort of conventional wisdom? Now, like you said, they're careerists, right? And they did, so is that motivation enough at this point? Or is the ideological capture so strong that even their careerism, even their personal interests...
start executing hostages, basically?
Yes.
I mean, they believe this stuff. Like, it might be enough for... I mean... losing to Glenn Youngkin was enough to make Terry McAuliffe, who I talked to like 2 days mm-hmm. after his loss, mm-hmm. say, wow, I should have just run as Terry McAuliffe, who's the mean DC Democratic lobbyist who will slit your throat, wants to win elections, like kind of Clinton type person. He said, instead I ran as this wokester.
There's still nefarious BS happening in Virginia schools, though. So, like, that's a good example because, and that's not to say it hasn't had a huge effect. And I don't know what the net aggregate effect it has been in Virginia. And we should talk to Virginia parents and ask them about that. Follow up with them on the documentary we filmed like exactly a year ago this week. But you still see, like, because the ideological capture of our education system is so strong because of the unions, because of the people who tend to take these positions, you still see some of this disgusting BS reported on like a monthly basis happening in Virginia.
Yeah, they haven't fixed it because Glenn Youngkin doesn't do what's necessary to actually fix it. Are Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell going to save the Republic?
Well, I don't know if it's even Glenn Youngkin so much as it is. I mean, I don't follow Virginia closely enough to know if it's Glenn Youngkin, but it's clearly also the fact that you have a society that has been radically reshaped by our cultural arbiters in Hollywood, in the news media, and in education. So people who go through education school think of things in that sort of progressive or bigot binary system, and you cannot deprogram that just because Glenn Youngkin wins an election. So the question has that ideological capture of the Democratic Party been so complete that you can't turn the Titanic around, or do their sort of career interests and their interests in winning outweigh that in the end?
A couple elections, I think.
I think you're right.
I mean,
I think you're
it's
right.
It's like Elon Musk takes over Twitter. Great. Awesome. Twitter's still a left-wing cesspool.
Well, to your
sociopaths.
Right. Yeah, to your point. And Twitter is actually a relatively small company compared to the United States government.
It's got a lot of employees, though.
Way too many employees for the amount of money it makes. So anyway, all that is to say.
The United States government has a lot of employees for the amount of money it makes.
I saw Sarah Amari tweeting this week something like sarcastically, can't wait for the quote or the all caps based new Republican Party to take power. And he said something like, you know, they'll just continue to do the bidding of, you know, corporate class, whatever, which is a sentiment that I fully understand. What I don't think is I think it's sort of a straw man that everybody who's like excited about some new figures in the Republican Party, like think of a Blake Masters, are convinced that those people are going to go to Washington and change the whole system. I just don't think that's true.
Yeah, Jim Jordan's got a new bill to slap tech. That's cool. That's good. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But it's not. That can't be your agenda, Kevin McCarthy.
So
that can't be the centerpiece of your agenda if you want to actually change big tech's power over Americans, because you're not going to change the way they think.
You're going to have to make donors mad.
You have to break their power.
So where do you stand on how Republicans are going to wield their power, not just in Washington, D.C., but say they end up with power in Oregon, say that Caruso wins in L.A.?
Oregon will be good. Both the independent is not going to win, most likely, and the Republican might win. Say that they're going to use state police to enforce law in Portland. City council, be damned. Mm-hmm. State police officers will come into your city, arrest you, and the state will charge these individuals. Not going to leave it up to the city anymore. That's the kind of raw action that is absolutely necessary. I mean, what could Republicans do? They could come in and say the IRS's budget is cut by this many people. All of those people you hired are now laid off.
Well, see, now corporations would be very happy about that.
They could come in and say, the military, where you're exercising civilian control over the Department of Defense, the military must rehire and back pay all soldiers, airmen, sailors, Marines fired over vaccine mandates. They could come in. I mean, they're not going to be able to get all of this done remotely, but that one would be interesting. Make the Democrats defend military control of the military over civilian control. Make the Democrats vote to unemploy people over vaccine mandates. Do it. Mm-hmm. See if you can. I mean, if the Republicans end up with 53 or 54 mm-hmm. senators, which is possible mm-hmm. right now, then okay, peel off six Democrats. Go in there and say, oh yeah, that bill that just that bill that just sends taxpayer money every single year to American colleges and universities. We're no longer doing that. Mm-hmm. No more money for universities. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that they're going to do these things.
I think they'll do some of them. But no, I mean, I don't think they really, I don't think all of them really have the will to upset donors the way that they would have to, or
I'll
to
trade
to
you World War III in Europe for a border wall. Mm-hmm. Like, how about this, guys? Well, we could have some javelins, but we get to put some javelins in the southern border. Just kidding. A wall. Remember Trump's alligator idea that everyone thought was real?
Yes, I do remember that. He wanted a moat, right?
He trolled people.
He wanted a moat.
Yeah. Well, we have a moat. It's a Rio Grande.
No, but he wanted gators in the Rio Grande?
Yeah, I mean, but he was...
I thought he wanted to, in other places, like, actually by the where the wall is, not by the water, like, put a moat in by the wall.
I think he was trolling everyone and having fun.
I'm just trying to remember how he phrased it, because it was legitimately pretty funny. Right. So that is a huge open question, and it does factor into voters' decisions as to whether they should go out and vote for these Republicans, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think it's important to sort of, it's so easy to get caught up in the cycle, especially as you're in the week of the election. But with a broadened, I guess, aperture, I think you're right, Chris, that you have to basically shift these foundational incentives for Republicans and Democrats so that, like, on the state level, at the mayoral level, they cut the Chesapeake BS and make it so there's absolutely no political incentive for anybody who subscribes to that ideology to be anywhere near a position of power. I do think because of the ideological capture, that's going to take some time, but I think we're probably seeing a step in the right direction.
Like, they'll get into the HR department, just like usually staffed by people in their early 20s. Mm-hmm. And then they'll exercise control over officers of a company.
Yeah.
It's kind of wild.
Well, yeah, it's happening in the political level and at the cultural level.
In the corporate level, corporations, it's happening. Nonprofits are paralyzed by it.
I mean, why do people post the black box for BLM? Well, it's because
they were solving racism.
But I'm saying,
weren't you a part of that historic day when racism ended?
What we may see is an early step in this sort of dramatic foundational shifting of incentives. And that's, you should never expect your politicians to be perfect stewards of moral greatness. That's just not going to happen 99.999% of the time. But that doesn't mean you can't be a part of shifting that incentive system.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's going to move further and further. The amount of Republicans who will, I mean, Republicans and conservatives have only just begun to really fight, mm-hmm. I believe, in the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. Republicans were able to very successfully fill the void left by the collapse of liberal politics in the 70s.
That's a good way to say that.
And they were able to do a lot of things. And then we were like, oh, that was a winning formula. Let's continue with that forever as we just as Republicans got their butts kicked over and over and over again for the next couple of years. And when the Republican administrations were elected, didn't do the things that they promised to mm-hmm. do ever. But that mode has started to change, 2016.
Well, they'll do what they promise to do if it's on the economy.
Like, no, yeah. They don't like the other issues, but they have to. I mean, it's the culture war, stupid. Mm. It's the economy, stupid. It's both of those things.
Well, Reagan saying it's morning in America, that's a culture war point. In the same way that Joe Biden saying this is a battle for the soul of America is a culture war point. It's just a really terrible interpretation of the culture war.
But the amount of Republicans who will now be, I'll be look forward to doing the count, probably writing about it. The amount of people who will be Republican congressmen and senators who'd only been elected since Donald Trump was on the ticket, mm-hmm. or since the GOP had started to shift, or since the corporatists and the neocons had started to be pushed. The neocons went back to the Democratic Party, and the corporatists went back to the Democratic Party.
I mean, even Kevin McCarthy saying it's not going to be a blank check for Ukraine. That's not coming necessarily because Kevin McCarthy's ideology to the extent exists has changed. It's coming from a point where he knows that the incentives among voters have changed.
Yeah, and he's savvy. He listens to voters. He listens to the base. and he tries to thread that needle and figure out where they're going. He, more than a lot of other people in D.C., seems to understand where political winds are blowing.
The Republican base, yeah.
And will move with them.
As well, much as to the can. Extent that he's willing
as
to.
As much as, you know, I mean, yeah. You know, he'll run it by Frank Luntz, but they'll generally listen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, and that, I actually feel like that's helpful perspective because it spares us from having to expect in the impossible from Republican politicians or even from any given moment in history. Like this is I think this is actually a very painful moment in American history, not because every moment has its pains. And you can sort of choose to have a glass half full or glass half empty interpretation of any moment of American history, but actually because we're drowning in misery. Like we are being fed food that is really bad for us. Like we are physically miserable. We don't exercise. We're coming out of a pandemic where people were sedentary for a couple of years eating junk food and watching Netflix.
All of us having, by the way, the most ambitious, I don't have to go to work anymore workout plans. I had such a, I'm going to get healthy a couple of weeks. It's like working out. I mean, by the end of it, I was drinking rum and Coke.
Like, you were doing that in the beginning.
It was a dark place.
Yeah, but we're sort of drowning in these very new technologies where there haven't been corrections, and it's still like yet to be determined as to whether we will correct before we get to full dystopia. Like it is actually right. No, 100%. 100%.
Do we have the muscle memory? Does America have the muscle memory to put virtue back in front of just blanket check freedom? Mm-hmm. And I am extremely doubtful that people who understand that even want it. Mm-hmm. But on a lighter note,
that's a great point.
Who do you think staffs Joe Biden's advance? Like who's that guy's advance team? The ones who are like, all dog. Right, we're going to go to Philadelphia to Constitution Hall, beautiful building, city of brotherly love. Can you make this look like hellscape Nazi speech? And then they're like, all right, we're gonna go to Union Station.
And by the way, when you're writing it, can you also make it sound like a hellscape?
Yeah. Can we get him one of those like, you know, megaphones and people yell through at street rallies? And get some marching behind him. And then we're like, let's go to Union Station. A beautiful neoclassical building, stunning backdrop. All right, now put him in front of a blue screen.
You couldn't see any of Union Station.
Why did they do it in Union Station?
Because it could have been from the White House. You literally had no idea.
They couldn't, though. That's the thing. That's why both these speeches. They're not admitting their political
speeches.
From the viewer's
perspective, right? Yeah. Like, you wouldn't have any idea
where he is. He could have been in the box.
Yeah. He could have been in the studio, seriously.
From the White House. The White House is claiming these are presidential addresses, not presidential political speeches. Mm-hmm. But they don't want to run afoul, so they haven't been giving them from the Oval Office because they're so obviously political speeches. Mm-hmm. But I mean,
whereas Trump was just like, yeah, we'll do the RNC at the White House.
Yeah, Donald Trump, he take a look at the backdrops he used. Mount Rushmore, the U.S. Capitol, the Fort McHenry, like his showmanship, and then compare it to the Joe Biden advance team, which just might be the worst in modern presidential history.
It's been so bad, and it's inexplicable to a degree, except for when you realize that they're all in this bubble where they're watching MSNBC and CNN, where the only Republicans allowed on the air are full morons that have no connection to reality or the Republican base. And
yeah, if you want to contract those journalists, as like a Republican or conservative commentator on those channels, the trick is gain 75 pounds, grow a goatee, and like hit your head in the bicycle accident.
So I've never been a huge George Will fan, but the column that was circulating a lot yesterday.
Gosh, did you read it? No, okay. I don't read George Will.
So this particular column was like, I have mad respect for this column because it really just popped the bubble, surely. That, like, again, the reason you and I don't read him is precisely because of what we're talking about, that he's one of the Republicans that, you know, the White House will read, right? One of the only Republicans the White House probably reads and is in their media diet because he's wildly disconnected from the reality of the Republican Party. And from his point of view, that's a good thing. But from our point of view, it makes him, you know, rather out of touch in an unhelpful and not constructive way, but this column laid bare, like, he used direct Joe Biden quotes and direct Kamala Harris quotes that make absolutely no sense and make them both sound like John Fetterman, and just put them in the Washington Post. And like, he seriously just quoted verbatim Kamala Harris talking about school buses and outer space.
School buses and outer space bring and time. The bus with the space in all of us.
Right. The passage of time, right? Amazing. And that's the kind of thing, as much as we don't read the George Wells of the world, that's the kind of thing that when you see it, it's so stark and you just realize what a false reality the media has constructed.
Imagine being George Wells' assistant. I remember a column he wrote in 2016 where he's like, he'd had enough. Donald Trump was a nominee and he went home to his house in Georgetown. He made himself a martini, which I don't begrudge, but I don't admit, like, you don't admit that. I made myself a martini and I told my assistant to change my party affiliation. And I imagine being his assistant, like George Will sitting there drinking, like, change me, change my party affiliation. I don't know how to change my own. And it's like, what'd you do? It's like, I just told him I did it.
It's like,
I did it. Of course, I didn't do it. What do you call the Republican Party? Take George, Mr. Will off your rolls.
It's like Michael Scott just walking out and saying, I declare bankruptcy.
Yes, exactly.
And it's done. That's it.
Although we had a George Will moment, kind of a throwback moment earlier today. I was walking out the door and Sarah said, I like those pants. It's a nice crease. I said, hello, David Brooks. And she didn't get it. Did you get it?
You're so lucky to have found her.
So David Brooks was like one of those first pseudo-intellectuals to go lib for Barack Obama because, you know, America's history of racism or whatever. And he went into the Oval Office and wrote this thing about how he saw this crease in Obama's pants. And he knew that this man was presidential. So I'm like, that's kind of racist, David Brooks. Like, ironed his pants?
Yep. Yep.
And since then, I mean, he's just... Like, there's no point to reading his columns anymore.
Yeah, well, there's a point to the extent that you're like, oh, yeah, this is what people will think passes for, like, heterodox, intelligent commentary.
Well, he is a great voice for morality when he's not, you know, marrying women as old as his daughter. He's a great voice for morality.
You know what? That's such a bad, like, that is such a bad insult from you, because if you didn't have a beautiful fiance, you would aspire to... marry someone the age that could be your daughter.
but once I'm a Catholic, so once married and having daughters, you stop. You don't get married again. That's it.
Oh, goodness gracious.
And then if you have to and you already have a family, well, then don't get a girlfriend as old as your daughter. I've seen a couple guys do it. Seems like a great idea amongst your friends. You know who it doesn't go over well with?
Women.
Your daughter. Yeah. In particular, it goes very poorly for you.
There's a great song. There's a great song called Old Men, Young Women that you should look up.
Yeah, and Watermelon Wine.
Okay. Anyway, as we're closing, I just want to mention I watched two documentaries on HBO this week. Wait, no, one was on Hulu. One was on Hulu. The HBO documentary was like year one of the Biden presidency, and it basically could have been put out by the DNC except for any of the sections that touched on Afghanistan. It was just a full different universe than what the country really experienced from Joe Biden. And then the other was a Hulu documentary that was really interesting on the sort of fall of Jerry Falwell Jr.
in real life.
It had some like super interesting stuff behind the scenes of everything that took down Jerry Falwell Jr. Of course, it was from one side, but then it's just used Jerry Falwell Jr. to smear all evangelical Christians and included something that I think speaks to what we were just talking about, this like false reality the media creates. It linked to a piece about how Timothy McVeigh was this like white Christian nationalist. And I see that.
He was a pagan.
So I see that. I'm like, there's no. So I start Googling just to like find exact quotes from Timothy McVeigh. And I stumble onto a Molly Hemingway article from 2010. Basically summarizing summarizing why Timothy McVeigh is absolutely not a Christian. And in this,
he was a Nazi.
But here's the thing, like they planted that seed so long ago and it has grown into trees where they end up in Disney, Hulu documentaries.
Here's the wait, like the hippies, like who ruined the 60s, waited 20 years before the 30 years, 40 years before they started making VH1 documentaries about how Woodstock wasn't disgusting.
So
like, the 60s were peaceful and awesome.
Yeah, but this, so these documentarians who, you know, are whatever, and the people who are fact-checking them at HBO, whatever, like their whole thing is about how Jerry Falwell is just one of many people in a long line of white Christian nationalists that instigated January 6th and is fanning the flames of political violence, et cetera, et cetera. And they use this as a big example. They put an article up on the screen that is completely wrong and actually does nothing. I went and read it to link Jerry Falwell Jr. Or to link Timothy McVeigh to Christianity in a sort of deep religious sense. So all that is to say, I think we are sort of blessed, at least to be, if we need to find the glass half full, living in a moment where the old guard and the old gatekeepers of the legacy media have less power than they used to. And I do think there's a good glass half full perspective that what might happen next week, if you and I's expectations are correct, could be a step forward and part of a bigger process of things starting to go in a better direction, because it's when you hit rock bottom, that's the only place you can go up from. But have we hit rock bottom?
No,
we don't know yet.
We're not at rock bottom.
Well, we don't know yet. No, we don't know yet. And that's the good news.
No, I mean, anyone who's ever known an addict, which most people have, you think they hit rock bottom. And then it's like they just roll over and it's like, oh, that's another mile cliff you just managed to go off. I don't know how you did that.
Any final thoughts, Chris, other than that?
Looking forward to Tuesday. Where are you going to, what's the best way to watch an election?
I mean, drunk.
I think bars, drunk, or death, obviously.
No.
Bars are too loud. No. Watch parties are too noisy. You can't actually pay attention. What are your plans?
I'll be broadcasting live over at Breaking Points. What about you?
Awesome.
Yeah. I'll be on Megyn Kelly's show too.
Oh, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to drink.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think Sarah's going to make a bunch of appetizers.
Ooh, her buffalo chicken dip.
I asked for buffalo chicken. It's like good. Super Bowl for nerds.
I love that buffalo chicken
dip.
Yeah,
I'm going to sit there and I'm going to have like iPad open, two laptops open, TV on, and a couple other people who are smart come over and just soak it.
Have her make you a turkey. She makes really good Thanksgiving turkeys.
I'm in charge of turkeys.
Okay. Well, she does a really good job with that.
I'm in charge of turkeys.
I just remember that from last year. Yeah, you were there. That was a good turkey.
Yeah.
She did well.
I'm in charge of the turkey.
All right. Whatever. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Druszynski, culture editor here at the Federalist, joined today by Christopher Bedford of the Common Sense
Society. I'm the turkey guy.
You're the turkey guy. He's the turkey guy. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.